Justin Cronin is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. His 2002 novel Mary and O'Neill won the Penn Hemingway Award, but Cronin's shifting gears with his latest novel, The Passage. The Passage has been described as an engrossingly horrific account of a post-apocalyptic America. So it may come as a surprise to learn that the genesis of the novel lies in conversations that Cronin had with his daughter, Iris, in 2006.
It happened in a sort of wonderful serendipity and also just a moment of parenting. My daughter, who was 8 at the time, came to me with concern that perhaps I was not living up to my potential as a writer. We were talking about books. She's a great reader, and we were just talking about good stories and bad stories, and she expressed the concern that perhaps my books were not interesting enough. And I said, okay, fine, Miss Smarty Pants, what should I write about? And she said, I think you should write a book about a girl who saves the world, and that it should be interesting, and that it should have a character, one character with red hair.
Is there any possibility that she has red hair?
You got that one right. Yeah, you don't even need to ask it. I took up this dare really just for fun. We spent about 3 months together, always in motion. We would do this when I was jogging at the end of the day, and she would follow along on her bicycle. I think the whole point of the exercise was actually to help her improve her bicycle riding skills. And we would float around my West Houston neighborhood spinning out a story with no expectations. I had no sense that I was ever going to write the thing. But it got good. It was what happened, really. Over the course of the 3 months, I began to feel that I was onto something. And when I hadn't taken any notes, and so at the end of the 3 months, when the weather got cold and the bike went into the garage, I decided that I would just type it up, you know, just so I wouldn't lose it. And I looked up 2 weeks later, it was right around Christmas time, and I had 30 pages of notes, this dense single space document. What I knew at that point was that I certainly had a plot, but the question is, did I have a story? Came down to if the book had a voice, a way of telling itself. So I sat down to write a chapter, and it immediately gave itself up like that. And I was writing another book at the time. I had lots of other professional commitments. But I just started throwing things over the side of the boat as fast as I could to make way for writing this.
The Passage is almost 800 pages long, and it's the first book in a trilogy. Can you give me a quick overview of the storyline?
Boy, did I have to figure this one out, too, because for the first time anybody asked me that, I think my head burst, because it is a very, very big story with a cast of a lot of characters, and it has aspects of a horror novel and a vampire novel and a thriller and a Western and a coming-of-age novel and a war novel. It's got all these different types of books inside of it. Essentially, it is this. It is a story of before and after. The before is a series of events leading to something known as the Great Viral Cataclysm, which decimates the North American continent and probably the world, leaving behind about 40 million vampire-like creatures, extremely dangerous, almost impossible to kill, and nearly immortal, and very few human survivors. The after takes place about 100 years later, when a group of survivors, they're the descendants of children who were evacuated from Philadelphia in the last days of the war. These descendants make a journey across a dangerous North American continent from California to Colorado, led by a mysterious young girl who may hold the secret to saving humanity, the girl who saves the world that was requested by my own daughter.
Yeah. The monsters of this book, the vampires, as you call them, are actually vampires. They're referred to as virals, mostly, during the story. But in fact, are they vampires as we understand vampires from previous? Are they Bram Stoker vampires?
Here's the sort of the proposition of the book. Whenever you're working in an established storytelling tradition, like, say, vampire stories, you really got to make it your own. And when I decided that I would use vampires as the thing the little girl who saves the world would save the world from, what I thought was that I would have these be the real vampires, not the legendary vampires. Every legend is based on some kind of fact. I mean, no matter how you construe it, you know, King Arthur was not a handsome knight in shining armor. He was probably a pretty good local warlord in Cornwall who organized a group of other warlords to stave off the Anglo-Saxon invasion a few extra years. Every great legend begins somewhere in fact. I decided that I would examine what the fact behind the legend might be. And I invented a character who was a paleo-virologist. I think this is an entirely invented profession, but I'm allowed to do that. I write fiction. Who goes searching for what he believes to be a virus existing in nature that has occasionally crossed over into the human community, producing, among other things, a spectacularly long lifespan. though with perhaps some unpleasant side effects that he would like to perhaps shake out of the mix.
Yeah.
And this is what's known as Project Noah at the start of the book, and of course it goes spectacularly wrong.
Yeah, you decided to have a kind of scientific origin to this, and that's your reason. You wanted this military experiment gone wrong to lead us to who knows where.
Yeah, I mean, science has been the magic of my lifetime. I'm not opposed to a little bit of magic in a novel or a short story, and I think in all my books there's a moment or two where that could be construed as either completely plausible, psychologically plausible, or perhaps the visit of a divine hand. But in this case, what I decided was I wanted to write about the real vampires. In my lifetime, of course, science has provided more than enough objects and events of starry-eyed wonder. That's the era in which I've grown up, and that is the magic of my life.
I want to get a sense of who these people, and they're based on people anyway, who they are, who the virals are. And there's a passage in the book I wondered if you'd read that describes one of them, Zero.
Oh, the main character that you're going to be hearing from here, not directly, it's not first person, but his thoughts. He's basically a janitor. Something was wrong with Subject Zero. For 6 days straight, he hadn't come out of the corner, not even to feed. He just kind of hung there, like some kind of giant insect. Gray could see him on the infrared, a glowing blob in the shadows. From time to time, he'd change positions a few feet to the left or right, but that was it, and Gray had never seen him actually do this. Gray would just lift his face from the monitor or leave containment to get a cup of coffee or sneak a smoke in the break room, and by the time he looked again, he'd find Zero hanging someplace else. Hanging? Sticking? Hell, levitating? No one had explained a goddamn thing to Gray, not one word, like, for starters, what Zero actually was. There were things about him that Gray would have said were sort of human, such as he had two arms and two legs. There was a head where a head should be, and ears and eyes and a mouth. He even had something like a Johnson dangling down there, a curled-up little seahorse of a thing. But that's where the similarities stopped. For instance, Subject Zero glowed. In the infrared, any heat source would do that, but the image of Subject Zero flared on the screen like a lit match, almost too bright to look at. Even his crap glowed. His hairless body, smooth and shiny as glass, looked coiled. That was the word Gray thought of, like the skin was stretched over lengths of coiled rope, and his eyes were the orange of highway cones. But the teeth were the worst. Every once in a while, Gray would hear a little tinkling sound on the audio and knew that it was the sound of one more tooth dropped from Zero's mouth to the cement. They rained down at the rate of half a dozen a day. These went into the incinerator like everything else. It was one of Gray's jobs to sweep them up, and it gave him the shivers to see them, long as the little swords you'd get in a fancy drink. Just the thing if, say, you wanted to unzip a rabbit and empty it out in 2 seconds flat. There was something about him that was different than the others, too. Not that he looked all that different. The glow sticks were all a bunch of ugly bastards, and over the 6 months that Gray had been working on Level 4, he'd gotten used to their appearance. There were little differences, of course, that you could pick up if you looked hard. Number 6 was a little shorter than the others, number 9 a little more active, number 7 liked to eat hanging upside down and made a goddamn mess, number 1 was always chatting away that weird sound they made, a wet clicking from deep in their throats that reminded Gray of nothing.
There's something really almost like the vampires that you get in fiction, but there is this scientific basis. I guess it's your way of putting your own stamp on these.
Sure.
Vampires.
Yeah, I think that's every novelist's job. Anytime you sit down and write virtually any kind of novel, somebody has already been there first. You know, you're never really breaking entirely new ground. And it's our project, I think, as writers, is to be aware of that and to try to add to it. You're not inventing the wheel. You're improving the wheel. You're taking some ownership of the wheel. This was, for me, a kind of fun project to take every detail of legendary vampirism and find a way to explain it, to support it with some historical, biological fact, for instance, to give the creatures of the passage. And I call them creatures because the word vampire isn't, it's almost never used in the book. I mean, it's clearly there, but it's not used very often. They go by many other names. But to take all of these qualities and to make them seem as if they could have really come from someplace. And I gave them a lot of attributes of other things in the animal kingdom. They have many attributes of birds or schools of fish, the way they move. They have a single biological event inside their bodies which explains their condition. Essentially, their thymus gland has been turned back on as this very mysterious organ located between your trachea and your breastbone that has something to do with healing and the manufacture of T cells, but it's actually very poorly understood. So that every detail of the legend I tried to couch in some kind of scientific terms.
Did you worry about this at the beginning? Because vampires are all over the place these days. The Twilight novels, the HBO series True Blood. You had to have wondered, I mean, you could have created something else instead of the vampire, but the vampire or the virals, whatever name you use, they're a huge part of our modern zeitgeist, aren't they?
Yeah, I call it the vampire industrial complex. Obviously, there's a sense that vampires are the monsters of the moment. But I actually started this book before that happened. The fall that Iris and I had these conversations, that was about the same time that the first Stephanie Meyer's book came out. And of course, she's the big driver of this. But it took a couple of years to build. So when we were first fashioning the story and when I began to write, the template and the experience of vampirism that I was operating out of were really the vampire stories of my own youth, yeah. Were things like Dark Shadows, and which I watched every afternoon after school at 3:30.
And from there to Buffy, sure.
If I had written this book 10 years ago, everybody would be saying, well, what does this have in common with Buffy the Vampire Slayer? They've never gone away. There's always the vampire story that we are engaging with, or the next one that we're ready to engage with. They've never gone away.
Do you think it's the immortality that is at the root of our interest in them?
Yeah, I think that's true. A lot of people say that it's a narrative basically of seduction, and it is. There's no question about that. But for me, the strongest part of that story is its exploration of the question, what part of your humanity would you be trading away were you to become immortal? In other words, how much of the sweetness and richness of being alive and being a human being is dependent upon the fact that it's finite? And I think that's a question we ask ourselves many times in our lives, and really in two distinct places. I think young people making the transition from the sort of the immortal state of being young. I mean, when you're young, you really feel like you're going to live forever. And then one day, all of a sudden, you realize that you're getting all these new privileges and things. You can drive, you can get a job, you can have your own money. But what comes with this, of course, is a lot of burdens. All of a sudden you have to be responsible and you have to pay your bills. And that's a moment, I think, when people encounter this question. And then I think later on in life, we encounter this question when you realize that the journey of your life is, say, well down the road, and you realize that you're not waiting for your life to start. It already has. Yeah. And you've accumulated a lot of experience, and you realize, oh, this is my life. It will end someday. And I think it's a question we all wrestle with, even when, of course, the answer is obvious. But nevertheless, we have to face it.